Hi, my name is Lena Fersch and I have been in love with improvised theater for half my life. Lately, however, things haven't exactly been great. Improv and I were going through a rough patch and I need some outside help. I really want to get the spark back in the relationship. So I decided to talk to improvisers from around the globe to seek advice. How can I make up with improv? Let's find out. Today I am speaking with Jason Geary from Melbourne, Australia. Jason is an alumni and former artistic director of Impro Melbourne, and he usually travels and teaches all around the world. Obviously, not at the moment, but he's still involved in many different projects, and you can find some links in the bio of this episode. It turns out, Jason actually went through a very similar thing than me. He needed to take a break from improv not long ago, and so we have something to discuss. Also, I wanted to find out what's up with his new owl tattoos, so I asked about that as well, and if you want to know, you should keep listening.
Well, I've been nervous about this all day, and I don't mind if you put this on the podcast as well, but I've been nervous about this because I've been going through a process of trying to fall back in love with improv as well. You know, I've had... quite the journey, and I don't want to come across as a grumpy old pessimist. So I'm like, okay, I do love it. It's fantastic, but there might be times where I'm just like, oh, improv. I just like feel like Krusty the Clown, just kind of sipping on wine and going, oh, it's such a frustrating thing sometimes.
It is. It's the best at sometimes. It's the worst at sometimes. And in a way, I feel like it's not that different with any relationship that you're in, right?
So I have a question for you, and maybe if you already haven't started, and I don't mind if you have, but I have a question to kick things off for you, which is like, what was the moment when you realized you were a little bit out of love with improv?
I can't say that it was a particular moment. I realized that I'd be more frustrated after shows, and mm-hmm. I'd be much more critical with everything. Another thing that started bugging me was that I'm being paid for teaching, but I'm not really paid for performing because the system, I don't know how it is in Australia, but the system is built like when we invite someone to play with us, we can say, we'll pay you, you know, 50 euros and then, or maybe like 100 and then you'll get accommodation, you'll sleep on my couch and, you know, that sort of thing. And it's nice. It's because it's also a community feeling that comes with it that I really enjoy. But, I feel like if you want to do it professionally, really dig into it, there needs to be some money involved so you can really work on things. And I got frustrated with having to prioritize other things over it as well.
Yeah, for me, it wasn't necessarily, it was the same kind of thing. It wasn't necessarily falling out of love with improv. It was falling out of love with everything surrounding improv and the demands on my time that was happening. I spent a few years as artistic director of Impro Melbourne, and that was a few years ago now, because I only did one term of it. And it was an incredibly frustrating time because for me, it was my goal for so long. I wanted to be an artistic director. I wanted to be the artistic director of Impro Melbourne. And when I got there, it became so little of the work I was doing was about artistic things. It was more about managing company and managing people and managing energy. So I know that's a part of it, but for me, that's, you know, maybe what a general manager of a company does or things like that. And so I spent so much energy and so much time just trying to keep people connected and afloat that I lost my connection with the work. Impro Melbourne's a very diverse company. Some people want to do more dramatic, focused, grounded stuff. We also have the license for theatre sports and stuff like that.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Oftentimes, you know, the focus is on comedy. And I was lucky that – I feel like I'm lucky that I got the best of both worlds with that through the company and my training there. And I was there for almost 17 years before I took on the AD-ship with the company. And I was really lucky. I spent 8 years under Paddy Styles, who many of your listeners know. So Paddy was artistic director before me. And there was another one between her and I. So there was another person between her and I. And it was always going to be a tough act to follow to be AD after Paddy was. And that AD was again, really, really great, but could never kind of, you know, stand up to the scrutiny of coming straight off the back of Paddy. And then he stood down, and it was almost like one of those movies where someone said, can we have someone who wants to be AD? And I was always interested. And when they asked for a volunteer, everyone else stepped backwards. And I was just kind of left out the front. and so I was like, okay, well, I'll take on, I'll do this. And so, everything that had been bubbling away in my head for so long, I started to put into action. And maybe it was a bit too much change too quickly or whatever, but it was a bumpy road from then on for me. So I started doing things and getting formats on and people's work that I really enjoyed. And I'm still really proud of a lot of the work that I did as artistic director. But for the most part, it was facilitating other people's work, and I started losing touch with my own work, and it became far less about the improv for me and more about running the company, keeping people's hopes and dreams alive and trying to keep egos in check and all those wonderful things that you have when you're working with a largely volunteer company. And so it was all too much for me. Like, I was just like, I just fell out of love with improv. I fell out of love with improv companies. Mm-hmm. I was just like, I can't anymore. So I stood down at the end of my tenure. So I did my 3 years and stood back down. And I've worked with Impro Melbourne since. There was no real bad blood there, but I just knew that I couldn't do it. It just kind of crushed me a little under the weight of it all. And it took me a while to start getting back into improv. I'd still kept teaching and I still kept performing little things here and there, but I had a good 8 to 12 months off. And one of the first things I did actually was come to Würzburg at the most recent time. Yeah. And so that was kind of me getting back on the horse a little bit. And because of that opportunity, I was able to, because it's so far from Australia, I always try to line up other things around whatever I'm going on for. So I managed to get to Barcelona as well for that festival, and I managed to go through Italy and work with the Tetrabu boys and the theatre there, which is really lovely. So that kind of just started to put the wind back in my sails a little bit. And so I fell out of love with improv just because I lost touch with what I loved about it during my tenure as artistic director. Does that sound like it's familiar?
Definitely. A lot of it rings a bell. For me, with the festival, for instance, that I stepped down as producer and artistic director, I don't even think that people necessarily were expecting me to do the things that I thought that were expected from me. I thought it was my job to make everybody happy. And so I worked hard to try and achieve that, because I felt like, what do they want? How can I give them what they want so that they're inspired and motivated to do this together? It was my dream for them to sort of go, I have a vision in that department, you know, because not everybody who runs the festival is an improviser as well. You know, for instance, Katrin, who was like running the improv office for a long time and did an amazing job doing that. She never wanted to go on stage. And that's great. I like that. I like that people from different, you know, with different talents, different backgrounds come together to produce something. And my dream was for everyone to sort of have their own vision, and then it all comes together. And I constantly felt like I was failing in giving them that, because people they have a big love for the thing, but also obviously they have their lives going on, and people were moving away, and people started having families, and people started new jobs. And I guess the festival couldn't be the priority that I wanted it to be for people. If they're listening now, maybe they think, I got it all wrong. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. It's hard to it's a hard position to be in because there's nothing you can really do because you're trying to please all the people, and that's all I wanted to do too. Is I wanted to give people the opportunity to do the work that they love and they were impassioned about on stage or in a festival or whatever. But also you got to understand, and I couldn't really see this while I was in the thick of it as well, is you can't please all the people all the time. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. there's always going to be a portion that aren't going to, you know, be completely jazzed about this or that. And so it's kind of a, in Australia, we call it like a mug's game, like a fool's errand, you know, just to kind of expect that. And I think I almost set my standards too high in a sense of what I was responsible for because I didn't want to let anyone down. But I just by the nature of managing a large group of people, all who have different wants and needs, you're going to let people down at some point, you know?
And I think there is also a big danger in trying to please everyone because what I found, what happened with me is that, you know, I thought, look, I'm giving you everything here. I'm really trying that you're having a good time. And then when I was criticized for something or if someone didn't do the thing that I thought was necessary, I got frustrated with them. And I think I oftentimes wasn't a very nice person to be around because my frustration just sort of changed the air in the room. And I'm not used to being that person. So I got frustrated. Yeah. Because I have it like identify as someone who's very, you know, happy and bubbly and who can, you know, I come into a room and I feel there's a little bit of tension. I can say something, make a joke, make people feel, you know, just make people feel good. I'm the youngest child of four kids. And I felt like in my family also, that was a role that I often had. Like I would be the one making a joke, being cute, being happy. And suddenly I was in a position where I was like, I think I'm the grumpy one. And I didn't like being that person. I really didn't like it.
Yeah.
And it's unfair. It's unfair because it's always a matter of expectations and a matter of communication. Can you step up for yourself and say, this is what I want? And if you want something different, that's fine. We just really need to talk about it. And I find that difficult. And I studied communication and I find it really, really difficult.
Yeah, that was the hardest part for me is when I would, you know, hear through the grapevine or someone would say, this person saying this. And I'm like, why aren't they saying it to me? Like, I'd love to have a conversation about this. And so I said to you before we went to air that I don't want this to turn into a sour grapes podcast by any means. I'm just acknowledging that I don't think I had expectations as a leader that I think were too high, and whether that me striving for that I think may have disconnected me from some of the people around me. So in the time since then, I've really tried to pull it all apart and assess what happened in that process and what I would do differently if I had that opportunity again. But also in that process, I've had to re-fall in love with this art form that I've dedicated my life to, you know. But the good thing about it is thinking about what I really enjoy about the work and what I'd love others to get out of the work has led me to new workshop ideas and me wanting to teach the workshop that I taught in Würzburg for the 3 days there, the artist and the craft came from me going, how do I get people to honor their own ideas? Ideally, you know, this is what I do as an artistic director is I open up the Pandora's box in your head and give you some focus. And so I created a workshop that allowed me to do what I thought being an artistic director was, you know. And I've been so lucky that people all over who've taken that workshop have then years later gone, I actually got this idea for this show in that workshop or came up with this there. And I've been so happy to see the work that's done. So the Artist in the Craft workshop, for anyone who doesn't know, is literally me sitting in there with a group of people going, what do you want to do? What do you want to do with improv? Let's break it. Let's find it and trying to facilitate your ideas in the most helpful way for you. So by the end of the weekend, you have something that you want to take away and try and maybe get to a stay.
One thing that stuck, because I took that workshop with you, and one thing that stuck with me is the quote that you said, the only thing that takes time is resistance, I believe it was. I don't remember where it comes from, but just that quote sort of follows me around, not just with improvisation, but with so many different things, that really the only thing that takes time is resistance. If you have an idea and you want to try something, you need to do it. Because if you've done it, you've learned something from it. You know, you've done it, you've learned from it, you can take from it. But if you're just battling with it before you try to perfect it, before you put it into the world, you're going to be suffering and not really making progress. You will be making progress, but very slowly.
Yeah, yeah. And the workshop is trying to get a process that is safe to put on stage, you know, to go, all right, well, here's a safe space for these ideas. And there are some wild ideas that come out of it. Like, some of it is a slight twist on something we already know, and some of it is stuff that I'm like, wow, if that gets up and goes anywhere, it's going to be crazy. You know, it's just amazing. For me, it was that is the ideal thing. And then I started realizing that I could do this. I could be an artistic director as such, in air quotes, without having to manage a company, you know? And I started thinking, wow, this is what I'd love to do. You know, this is where the area that I love to work with is this area of working with newer improvisers, more experienced improvisers who are looking to dip their toe out of the pool that they're used to working in. And so, that thing of teaching improv, but also learning to love performing it again. And the first spark of that, again, was at that Würzburg Festival where I did the show, the dinner.
That awkward dinner party.
Yeah, awkward dinner party, yeah.
Yeah.
It was such a wonderful experience. It was something that kind of put the wind back in my sails again.
Oh, that's really nice. It's like,
okay, this is the joy that I have. You know, I was on cloud nine, and as you know, you don't remember a whole lot of improv that you do, but I remember so many beats in that show and moments and stuff that I can use to kind of recharge that as well. And I think maybe, I don't know, just wondering aloud here, maybe that's part of the problem, because of what we do is so disposable and so in the moment, that, you know, at the end of the shows, I often forget to value it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was forgetting to go, oh, well, that was a wonderful thing that we did there. I would walk off stage and go, hey, great show, really nice. And, you know, drive home and feel like normal again. And so I forgot to value it as much as I did. And so that was something that I wanted to rectify as well. And the way that I've approached that is to just only say yes to the stuff I want to do now. Like, really want to do. And so I'm not, you know, doing formats that I've done to death or I'm not really interested in. I'm saying yes to people and their ideas rather than, you know, just for a bit of stage time or a show or a check or that kind of thing. And that's really put the pep back in my step here, you know.
I think what you just said about being really honest with oneself, do I want to do it? Do I want to say yes to this particular thing? Can I enthusiastically say yes to this? I found that this helps me to sort of find the joy again. For instance, I didn't do any online improvisation because I watched it, but I wasn't so interested in doing it myself. And then Vid Sodnik from Ljubljana, Slovenia, he asked me if I wanted to be like on a dubbing show online. And because I like them so much, I just like Igloo, and it seemed to be a silly, fun thing to do. I really felt like I wanted to say yes to this. And I had a great time, and it was a one-time thing, and it was just nice catching up with those guys, and we had some good laughs, and that's it. Yeah, I wanna have some experiences like that. And also what I would like is like a partner in crime. And because that helps. I remember when Luisa Winkler took over the festival from Nadine in, I think that must have been 2012, Luisa and I started working together really, really closely. Also, we're really good friends. So we would talk to each other like three times a day, twice. We would, you know, like catch each other up on what's happening in our lives, and one's about the festival. And I really enjoyed mm-hmm. that, like a close relationship where you're so in sync and you're going for the same thing and you have the same vision for something. That's like you're giving each other wind so you can move fast. And that's an amazing feeling. I miss that. I would like to have that again. You can't force it. You sort of need to be open, you know, to receive it when it wants to find you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you have to be open to it, but you also have to know where to look for it. You know, I don't think people should be shy about the people who inspire them and who they want to work with. You know, if it's someone who you think, I'm never going to, you know, that person may never want to work with me, start a conversation with them, you know, float your ideas. You never know what's going to light them up. And I've been blown away several times by people who have been inspired by my ideas. And I'm like, oh, cool. Let's go play. Or I've tugged on their coattails and said, hey, can I be a part of this? And they're like, yeah, that'd be great. And that's the position that we're in at the moment here in Melbourne is we have a comedy festival coming up. And as I mentioned before we started, our COVID situation here is a little bit better than most places at the moment. So we have the ability to do some live shows as of the start of this year. So in late March, early April is the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Now, the international part is not really happening this year. It's mainly local acts and some interstate acts as well from here in Australia. But I'm all of a sudden doing three shows in the festival. One came about because it's a format I've been doing almost since I got back from Würzburg around that time. The other show that I'm doing is just called The Return of the Secret Seven. And this came out of one day we were doing a jam here just before COVID hit. There were five of us who loved each other's work, don't get the opportunity to work together a whole lot, and said, let's just go do this jam night together. We'll book 20 minutes and go and do it. And we did it and had an absolute blast. And that was all of us kind of taking a chance on this thing. And when the opportunity came up to do a season, we all just went, yes, please. And that was just from a roll of the dice. That was just from that 20 minutes of, let's give it a go. Let's see how it goes, you know. And I think those are the opportunities that you can afford yourself if you're mm-hmm. wondering. Like, just go, let's find a spot. Let's find a low-stakes jam or something like that and give it a go. Of course, when those things can happen. I'm talking in a post-COVID-changed world. But if all else fails, just have a conversation about improv as well, you know. The podcast that I do with Dave Morris, In Conversation with Dave Morris, Jason Geary, is an improv-based podcast. And that came about because I was supposed to go to Dave's festival mm-hmm. and co-artistic direct that festival with him. Then COVID hit, so we decided to have all those late-night conversations that we'd normally have, you know, at 1 a.m. after shows at a pub or back in his lounge room because, as you said, I'd be sleeping on his couch or in a spare room or something like that. So we still wanted to have that experience. So we started the podcast with just us, and then we've started talking to a whole bunch of other people as well, mm-hmm. Which has been absolutely fantastic. And that just forms tighter bonds. We're just talking to people who light us up, who we find interesting. And it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. One thing that I'm, you know, trying to do with this podcast as well is finding out what lights people up beside mm-hmm. improvisation, because so many of us have so many things going on that are not entirely related to improvisation. And I don't know how it is in Australia, but in Germany, most of the improvisers I know aren't classically trained actors. There are scientists, there are, you know, people that studied law, there are writers. It's very diverse, and I think that's kind of cool that everybody has something else going on as well.
Yeah, I've been a drama student my whole life. Like I still remember the first laugh I got through improv. I was like in year 10 and I was improvising. And I was like, hang on a minute, I can do this for a living. Like, and so I've had a comedy career here in Australia. I've done TV shows, I've done stage stuff, I've done sketch comedy television here, sitcoms, the whole kind of stuff, that stuff, and, you know, television commercials, all of that sort of thing. So I guess my other is actory stuff, but really my passion is play. Like, I love board games and I love playing games and I love being playful. I have two grown kids now, but, you know, if they'll take the time to play with me, I'll play with them any day of the week. Aww. You know, I have a garage full of board games and that kind of stuff. And I just love it. Like, I love the interaction. I love the moment, I guess, in play. And so finding the play in improv again has been something that I've been trying to do, you know, finding that joy in play there. So stripping back that responsibility, working with people who inspire me, who I want to play with, really, really helps that. The other thing I do a bit is writing as well.
I know. You wrote a book.
I wrote a book in lockdown, just after lockdown hit here last year. We had our arts organization go, pitch us what you've got. We've got COVID grants. And I went, how about I write a book about Melbourne? And they went, okay. So I wrote a collection of short stories set here in Melbourne, and they're magical realism stories. It's called Lost and Found, Magical Stories from Melbourne. And you can get it online. It's just an ebook. It downloads as a PDF and an audio book.
I can put the link in the bio also.
Oh, sweet, sweet. And now I have another writing project that I do as well. I'm about to get back into it. It's called The Dictionary of Moments, which is a podcast. So I write three super short stories a week and then record them into a podcast that goes for about 15 minutes. But I've been taking a break from that since the end of the book. I've like, all right, I need some space from writing. But I am gearing up to get back into that as well, which is good.
Yeah, I listened to the audiobook for the first story about the... I forget the name, custodian. The third custodian.
Yep.
I quite liked it. I thought it was nice. I listened to it last night before I went to bed. I thought, this is, you know, I'm trying not to watch that much Netflix before sleeping. You know, it was nice. I listened to your voice and I listened to that story. And I was actually wondering about something because it's a story written in the I perspective. As a child, I did this and that. So how much Jason is in that protagonist?
Quite a bit of me is in that protagonist. A lot of the things that I mentioned there in the that happened to the character as a child. So the running over of the cat in the driveway, seeing the woman crying in my mum was a hairdresser, and whenever I was homesick, I'd have to go with her to work because they couldn't leave me at home. And so I remember seeing this woman crying at my mum's work, and only realizing more as an adult that, you know, she had a bruised face, and this was like the salon was like a sanctuary for these women sometimes, and they could, you know, talk openly and honestly and stuff. And here's me stuffed out the back coloring in stuff. And the football story as well, about the teams, the football teams and stuff. So it's a story about heartbreak. It's a story about the physicalization of heartbreak. So one of the characters in the story, the magical part of the story, is a character who collects heartbreak that falls off people. And so a lot of those stories about heartbreak that happened to the character as a child were things that I remember when there was a lot of sadness when I was a child as well. So a lot of the stuff in there was a true or a version of the truth. there's a lot of that, the younger stuff. Of course, it takes off into a direction that can't be true. But, so I'm actually shopping that around at the moment, trying to get it, see if anyone wants to make short films of it and stuff like that.
Nice.
It never stops. It never stops. I'd love to let me know what you think of the rest of the book.
Yeah, as well. Looking forward to hearing more of it. It's also got really nice illustrations. You worked with a friend for that, right?
uh, Yeah, Liam Amor, who is himself an amazing improviser and a lifelong friend. You know Rick Brown. Rick and Liam and I went to university together, so we've been working together for 27 years now. And yeah, the illustrations in the book are just sublime. Liam is an amazing artist. And so once I had a bit of money, I said, can you illustrate my book? And it's been one of my bucket lists for ages. And so the pictures in there are just stunning. It's amazing.
And also, it just seems like you have very talented friends. It's like, because I remember you on one of the many podcasts that you have that I listened in on. Yes. You said that, you know, when COVID hit, you called friends up and you tried to sort of, you know, just be in contact with friends. Little projects started happening, a video here, a video there. So it just seems like your friends are very talented and creative. And that's like a big treasure in a way.
Yeah, I'm very lucky to be surrounded by lots of creative people with creative energy. And I think we've had to all find our way a little bit here. So a lot of us were very open to things, and not everything came to fruition, but we did, you know, get used to doing stuff. We didn't do a lot of Zoom improv or stuff like that either. Like, I only said yes to one Zoom show as well, and that was a Dave Morris's Paper Street Theatre Zoom show. And for the very much the same reason, I adored the company and the people I was saying yes to. Mm-hmm. So the format was secondary, and I knew that I was just going to really love the work that was happening, and I did. But yeah, I'm lucky to be surrounded by an incredibly supportive and creative community.
Would you say that is like a Melbourne thing? Is Melbourne a very creative city?
Yeah, very much so. It's a very artistic city. I mean, we have the Comedy Festival here in Melbourne. We have an arts festival. We have a Fringe Festival as well, which are kind of 6 months apart, the Comedy and the Fringe Festival. So you kind of, when things are normal, you're on this endless loop of, I've finished one show, let's get a show ready for the next festival, and so forth. And then we often tour those around. But because we're such a big country, but such a small community that everyone kind of knows each other as well. And so, you know, it doesn't take long for you to build a reputation or meet new people. And I'm at the position now where I've just turned 47 years old, and I'm like the old guy in improv now. And so I start seeing people who are doing things that are really inspiring younger people, and younger people are kind of going, oh, we want to try this thing. Will you help us out? And so I'm in this really lovely position now where I can work with younger people who inspire me as well. Either help shape shows or just use that fuel a little bit that kind of young passion has, and they're chuffed enough to be working with me, and I'm super happy about that as well. So I'm finding myself really energized by young ideas and new ideas, and the fact that I can help tuck in the edges here and there, but you know, I'm just finding myself working with younger artists that are really inspiring to me, which is again, I think, helping me put some wind in the sails too.
Look at this. I made little drawings of stuff so that I don't forget what I want to know from you. Actually, one thing that I thought was interesting is why you picked an owl for a new tattoo. So maybe we can get into that as well.
Yes. So I have two new tattoos that I got for said just past 47th birthday. And the wonderful thing that happened with this is my 19-year-old daughter is interested in tattooing. So she's been practicing, and for Christmas we bought her some tattoo equipment, and so she's been tattooing a little bit. She's already done one tattoo on me, which turned out great, and so I was like, all right, for my birthday, I'd like an owl tattoo.
Oh, so she didn't just do the drawing. She tattooed it onto your skin.
Yes, she physically gave me the tattoo.
Wow.
She controlled the needle, put the ink in my arm, which as a father, having your daughter tattoo you is a pretty special thing. I love it very much, and it's something that she wants to do as a career. So she's trying to get an apprenticeship at the moment, but COVID's kind of put a stop to that at the moment, but hopefully she'll get into it soon. So at the moment, I'm her practice canvas, and and so is she. She tattoos her own legs and stuff.
Crazy.
And so, yeah, and so I – here's what happened. Here's why I wanted an owl. One reason is I love Twin Peaks. And one of the famous lines from Twin Peaks is the owls are not what they seem. And that is in reference to the owls being portals for spirits that live there. And I think that improv is about spirits coming together a lot of the time. If we're going to get into that part of the owl stuff, I think when kindred spirits find a match on stage and come together, and when you travel with improv, you find these people somehow find each other, and if you're lucky enough to perform with them or even just sit and have a chat with them, sometimes you feel that real connection. So I feel like there's that improv spirit in there as well. So from Twin Peaks comes that part of the owl stuff. But I was standing on my balcony. I have a two-story house. My bedroom has a small balcony off the front of it that overlooks a lovely stretch of wetlands and stuff like that that are over to some mountains. So from my balcony, you can see some houses, but basically you just see treetops and stuff.
That sounds lovely.
It's a beautiful, beautiful view. And so I went to my bedroom. The light was off, and it was a summer's night here a couple of weeks ago, so it was quite warm, and I had my sliding door of the balcony open, but I was standing just inside it, no light behind me, and I was just looking out over the world, as I like to do before I go to bed, and getting a nice breath of fresh air, and I hear tink tink, and I look down at the railing of my balcony that's maybe 3 feet away from me, and there's an owl just sitting there. And I didn't hear it fly because you can't hear owls fly. I just heard its feet go on the rail, and it started to move its head around, like rotate its head at me. And I was like, and I said out loud, I said, "Oh, hi, owl." And then the owl rotated its head even more, like in a little circle. Aww. And then it put its little wings out and did it some more. And then it was just so beautiful.
Aww.
And it was there for about a minute, and then my cat came between my feet and the owl took off. And my cat didn't see the owl, but the owl saw the cat and was like, "Okay, bye." And and so I was like, "Wow, that was beautiful."
Yeah.
And so it was such a lovely moment. But then I made the mistake before I went to sleep of Googling owl, close-up owl experiences. What does it mean? And it meant, like, it could be a spirit. It could be a spirit coming to visit you. And I'm like, did one of my parents just die? Like, I was like, oh, no. And then I started worrying that someone I knew had died and they'd just come to see me. And this was like at 1 a.m. So as soon as I could the next morning, I called both my parents.
That's funny. Like, but do you believe in that sort of thing? Do you believe that, like, in signs? Do you have superstitions?
I guess, yeah. I'm not a religious person. I don't subscribe to any religion, but I don't begrudge anyone's thought on that. Like, you do you. That's absolutely fine. But I guess for someone who doesn't really believe in religion in that form, I'm still a little superstitious. I'm still a little bit there. Like, I feel like there's, as I say, souls that connect, and there's some sort of deeper level going on here. I think there's a lot to do with karma, that kind of thing. Like, I think you get the energy that you put out, and so the times where I've received negative energy, I'm starting to go, well, what am I putting out? Let's see if we can change it at the source and that kind of thing. So I'm a little hodgepodge of beliefs, I think, a little bit from here and a little bit from there and a little bit made up.
It's like this whole idea of believing in something that's beyond what we see and what we experience. I think this is so interesting because I studied communication rhetorics, and my professor is a priest, a Catholic priest. We're still very close now. And I asked him, why do you believe in God, or how do you make yourself believe in that thing? And he says, you can't really make it. It's like you can't force it. It's just something that happens to you. You believe in it or you don't.
Yeah.
I find it interesting because I'm the same as you. I don't think I believe in like a Catholic God. I'm baptized mm-hmm. Catholic, but that's really
as
just
my,
yeah, it's really more on paper than anything else.
Yeah.
But I do believe in what you say as well, connection in a way. Mm-hmm. Like my brother has a very good friend and he got cancer at the age of 31 and it shook my family. And every night I would sit down on my bed and I would like not pray, but sort of send him thoughts mm-hmm. and, you know, just putting some positive energy into the world. And, you know, there were moments when I looked at myself and I thought, Lena, you're being absolutely ridiculous. But also I didn't really mind because nobody would see me doing it. It was just something that I did for myself. And also maybe it felt like I was a little bit in control, even though really I'm not in control of anything. But, you know, just this is the only thing I can do is like hoping for the best and consciously hoping for the best. I don't know if that's spirituality. I don't know if that's superstition. Doesn't matter, maybe.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't. I don't know that it does matter. You know, whatever you choose to be your cipher to put it out to the world or whatever structure you want to put it into, I think there's something bigger there. As I say, I've felt that spiritual connection, like that deep connection with people in an instant, and it's usually through play, whether it be, you know, over a board or on a stage or gagging around in a bar or afterwards or something like that. But one thing that I think anyone listening to this podcast would know is the generosity of spirit that most improvisers have. They're open. They're, you know, I can, if I think about, you know, even just the Würzburg bar, for example, yeah. You know, after a show or things like that, if I were to walk into a genuine public bar where I don't know people and that many people was there, I would just be like, okay, bye, I'm out of here. Whereas, you know, with improvisers, I think there's an openness and a willingness to accept people at face value, and that face value isn't necessarily, you know, people peacocking or things like that. You know, there's a lot of truth there. And the opposite is also true. I've been in improv bars where everyone's been peacocking at the same time. But generally, the people who I'm drawn to, I think there's that level of, you know, I think our spirits sit in the same nest, you know. We all live in the spiritual improv owlery.
No, I 100% agree. The first time I volunteered at the festival, that was in 2009, this whole community sort of took me by storm. I didn't know that something like that existed because people would talk to me and ask me how I was doing, what I was doing with my life, that were like the stars, if you will, in that time that were, you know, on stage in big venues. And then they would come down and just ask me how I was doing. And I wasn't used to being interesting to I was 19 years old. I thought, you know, I'm a teenager. Probably people who are here are not very interested in me and my life and my drama, but they were genuinely. So I think that obviously that and just seeing wonderful shows made me really fall in love with improvisation. And I went through all the phases. I went through the long distance relationship with improvisation. You know, I lived in Stuttgart, but my company was in Würzburg. So I would go as often as I could. And my parents would say, Lena, why don't you put some focus on your studies? Because we think that's important. And I said, I know, but also, no, I just want to go back home and do a show. Like, come watch the show.
Yeah, I think that journey is part of why it's so hard, what we were talking about before, of not wanting to let people down, because you want to keep that magic there for people. And so when you feel like that's not there or dissolving or eroding a little bit because of a decision that you've made or have had to make, then it's, you know, I wore that probably more heavily than I should have. I think that was part of it for me as well, because I understand the magic of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I want that magic to exist for everyone, but it's so hard to do when you're carrying the whole show on your back, or the whole company or things like that. And so yeah, I'm the first to admit that aiding an entire company was probably much more different than I expected it to be. But I think part of it was that expectation, like we said, that we set for ourselves, and that magic that we want to give everyone, you know. And that's what I hope. I hope people feel like they can come say hi in a bar. Like that's what I want improvisers to think of me as. Like, not as someone. I'd love if people were lovely enough to admire my work or do enjoy my workshops. But generally, I want to stay humble and approachable. And I think most great improvisers that I know are that.
Definitely. I also think the people that I most look up to on stage or as teachers are the ones that I feel I can just approach and ask a question and just go into a conversation with. Yeah, it's a very welcoming community. I remember sitting with people at the same table, and I thought, in real life, if you will, these people would never share a table. But because we're all connected through this passion of ours, it makes sense. Like, there is the 14-year-old that's, you know, volunteering, and then there is someone who runs his own company and does a lot of business improvisation, and then there is an organizer, and then there's like student, like everything just fits, even though it doesn't. And that's something that's quite beautiful. And also, it's not what I like about it, it's not as superficial. You see all sorts of different people on stage, and very rarely do you go, like, that doesn't make sense, because it all does. Hop on stage, do your thing. That's great. I like that about it very, very much. But this welcoming, like this welcoming thing, the saying yes, if it becomes a religion also, I think that's what makes it hard, because you can't be saying yes to anything. And I don't think that's what's intended. You know, it's more of a, like a state of acceptance. And once you go, you know, you need to say yes to everything, you're going to lose yourself. You're going to lose yourself. Period.
And we've seen, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years, how awfully sinister that can go as well. You know, that almost cultish kind of acceptance of yes as well. And if people who are in charge don't have people's best interest at heart, then that can go horribly wrong as well. So you know, having a thing that can be a little cultish and that trains people to say yes, you still need to create a culture that is supportive, not just a set of rules or an expectation. It was something that Patty created a culture at Impro Melbourne over the years that I was there that was so accepting and so supportive that I didn't realize until I started traveling that not all companies had that expectation of their casts, of their improvisers. And that's where I realized that the culture of the company is just as important as how they teach, you know. And so the companies that I've been drawn to around the world and worked with put culture as a top priority as well, and not just the work, not just the learning. But I think, like with any organization, that culture needs to be there. So on stage, people can drop their guard and can be vulnerable and not be taken advantage of as well.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, you need a strong base of values, of the culture, and you need to not be afraid for things to change, is what I find hard. You know, we do it on stage all the time, and yet it's just difficult. But, like, for instance, you know, it's hard to step down as producer and artistic director for the festival. And, you know, my boyfriend, he's still part of running it. So I have to be very clear and say, I think I should know about these things, because I will have opinions, and I don't think I should share them at this point. Because it's going to be different, and that's going to be great. And I was really lucky to also have teachers from various different backgrounds, not just improvisation, but also improvisation. And one of my teachers and now very, very good friends, Nadine Antler, who says hi. She says hi. I just talked to her.
Oh, yay.
Yeah.
Send my love, please.
she taught me that it's all about letting go, because she did it. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't just talking about it. She actually did it. And just now that I stepped down, we talked about it for a while. And she said, it was excruciatingly difficult seeing you and Luisa do your thing. And I was like, no, but this needs to be different. Yeah. But she just, you know, didn't say anything about it, trusting that whatever comes out of it is what comes out of it. And also, things aren't that precious, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we think we hold on to one thing because of nostalgia, because of a version that we of ourselves that we liked, and it's all just, I don't even know what it is. It's
transient. It's of the moment. But I think that's a pertinent point that should be made to company members as well, because for example, Impro Melbourne was run a certain way for so long under Paddy and amazingly as well. But then when leadership changes, there's going to be change, and then there's a resistance to that change as well, and people going, well, it was like this, why can't we just keep going like that? And as you mentioned, for a bunch of improvisers who train to adapt and train to say yes and to say yes, and a lot of times my biggest struggles were with people not doing that, not living their values as a part of a company, living it on stage 100%, the work, perfect, but not, you know, not having your back, not being willing to say yes and not willing to see the change or be prepared to pivot and stuff like that. And that was some of the challenge for me as well. And also some of the challenge that I see in companies around the world where people know their values of improv and live those improv values when they're part of a show, but are the very opposite of that when they're off stage. You know, they're stubborn, inflexible, they want things their way, demand things their way. And as I say, sometimes when you're not paying people, that's all they've got is what they're getting out of it. So they feel entitled, and it becomes this big blur of things. So I think both leaders but also company members need to have their back with that, be prepared to change. Because you're right, it can't stay the same. I think it's an absolute fool's game if you're there going, well, this is lovely, this bubble's going to stay here forever. It's not. People are going to move on. People are going to get jobs. People will move cities. People will have children. People will stop leading and go their own way.
And I think maybe I wasn't prepared to accept that also. Like, because it's one thing to go, other people, you know, don't live up to their values, but I find it in myself all the time, and I have to hold myself accountable for the times that I've fail in a way at
absolutely
staying true to these values. And also so many things are true at the same time, which makes life very complex, but also easier in a way, because you don't need so much judgment. If you know, if there is a lot of truth that is equally valid, then it's just a matter of communication and of clarifying where the two of us are at the moment, and it's not so much about this is right and this is wrong. So that, I think, also helps with this, because one could also argue if leadership changes in a company, it is also very important to sort of give people security at first, but still things need to change. And that's both very true.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And as I said before, I came in with lots of changes very quickly when I came in as well, because I was excited for that. And everything I've said about other people there absolutely applies to myself as well. But I think it's good if everyone in a company reflects on that. And there's that empathy there for everyone, rather than that kind of entitledness. And again, 100% honesty, I probably had that entitledness. Like when I took over, I was like, right, I've got this job now, I want these changes to happen, and could have slowed down and made it easier for people to transition. Absolutely. I know that as a truth now, but did I know it then? Not much, you know, I was still learning. But people don't give you the chance to learn. And so I was just like, two hands holding a roller coaster, let's go, where I probably should have been, come jump on, you know, let's sit down and listen.
What's funny is when I still produced the festival a couple of years ago, Patty came to Würzburg to teach a workshop for our volunteers, and we did a maestro at night, and I was playing in the Maestro. And then the next morning she said to me, Lena, what you do, like when something doesn't go right, you will save a scene, but you will do it by yourself. You're not including everyone and going like, okay, let's do this together. Like, let's take a step forward, but together. I'll just take a step forward. And I think that's a lot how I'm wired. And that made me go, oh, yes, this is what I do. I don't let people hop on the roller coaster. I think I need to, I sort of need to save it myself, which is, I think, a matter of, in my case, I can't speak for you, but for me, this is definitely a matter of trying to control things and not trusting that letting go would probably be a lot more helpful in that particular situation.
Yeah, I think, I think that on improv stage and in improv life is a good lesson to learn. I also had this complicated thing, as you mentioned before, as the previous artistic director, and I was the same when I left the role, you kind of look on and you kind of have to go, well, it's not mine anymore. I'll let it go. And so I was probably one of the luckiest people in the world, to be honest, to have my improv apprenticeship. I had Patty Styles 24/7, like out of 12 months of the year. Anyone who's worked with Patty knows how wonderful she is and how generous she is. And as an ex-AD of the company, I lost her as a resource because she didn't want to comment on the company anymore. And so to have someone as a mentor like that, a personal mentor, an improv mentor, and a great friend, and we're still great friends. There's no bad blood absolutely at all. But just reflecting on it now, I'm realizing that I couldn't, in those moments where maybe I wanted to ask for help and I would have asked for help from someone like Patty, there was that block there because it was her company once upon a time. Mm-hmm. And she very rightfully was stepping back from it to do her own thing. And so, yeah, there was, one avenue for advice or that experience that I'd leaned on all those years before was gone a little bit in that role too. But it taught me an awful lot. Would I do it again? Absolutely not. I know I'm not great at managing people. What I am good at is helping people focus their artistic ideas. And I'm really good at playing. And
yeah, so, I would love to play a board game with you once. Next time we see each other, we should get into that.
We're this board game arena online. We've got Tabletop Simulator. We could play over the internet.
Yes, you're right, especially now. I mean, now's the time to do that. That would be lovely. Yes,
face-to-face one day, absolutely. We'll create an afternoon somewhere where we can play some board games. That would be great.
Jason, it's been so lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for your time and
it's been
very inspiring talk.
Pleasure. Thank you, lovely.
Thank you.
Let's play games soon.
This was my conversation with Jason Geary from Melbourne. I hope you guys liked it as much as I did. I had a blast. In 2 weeks, I will be speaking with Simon Schwegler from Zurich, so make sure to tune in on Wednesday, the 31st of March. Also, there's one more thing. This podcast is produced by the Association of the Würzburger Improtheater Festival. Many of you might know our main annual event that usually happens at the end of October. But we also organize various other projects throughout the entire year. For instance, this podcast. If you'd like to support our work, you can help us with a donation. You can donate via PayPal. That's paypal.me/improvfestival or directly to our bank account. For more info, visit the link in the description. Thank you so much, and have a great day wherever you are on this planet.